Today is Monday, July 8th, and you're listening to The Job. This is The Job, a talk show about the web, design, Portland, music, business, culture, you name it. I'm your host, Ray Briglip. Our guest on this episode, number 20, is Tressa Yellig of Salt, Fire, and Time. But first, let's talk to Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
Well, we missed our broadcast last week. What with the holidays?
That is a shame.
Mm-hmm. It is a shame. We had a nice vacation. We made some s'mores, or as our daughter calls them, snores. Candace, that we ran out of graham crackers, so we invented a short snore, which is where you heat up a. Correct me if I'm wrong. You heat up a marshmallow and then you shove a piece of chocolate in it.
It's a little more complicated than that, Ray.
It's a little complicated to clean up.
The secret is to hold the marshmallow just at like medium heat until it's all warm and gooey and puffy on the inside.
Yeah, it has to swell up a little. Yeah.
And then right after that, you put it in the high heat so it crisps on the outside.
Right.
And then you put a little bit of chocolate right in the middle and eat it.
Like a little, like a little square of Hershey's, you'd say.
It has to be Hershey's, we found, for the melting quality.
Yeah.
We've tried a number of chocolates. It's almost as though, like, the better, fancier the chocolate, the less it's the right s'mores chocolate. I could be wrong. I have a list of s'mores experiments to do. The next is the Reese's peanut butter cup instead of the chocolate.
Your s'mores bucket list.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have right. one.
I've also been researching how I can make my own graham crackers. This is what happened. So we're starting camping, right? This is a new thing as a family.
Okay. Just tell us what's going on here, Candace. Just level with us.
This whole new camping adventure really just makes me think about how different we are in how we approach new endeavors.
Yeah.
So
I throw lots of money at it and then just try to relax and enjoy it and read a book.
Right. Yeah. And I feel as though like, I want to simplify things, but the moment they're simple, I want to complicate them. Like, you know, we decided that we would have one night where we had, not hot dogs, but what are like the bigger
kielbasas?
Yeah. So it's like, we've decided that, and instantly I start researching how to make my own kielbasa. Like
it's Like, no.
No.
Oh.
So I've been reading this book, Campfire Cookery, and it is amazing, really good. The reviews on Amazon are either like love it or hate it, like where are these women from, or this is exactly the camp book I needed. And I am really enjoying it, but one of their suggestions is something that I'm just not sure I can do, but it's basically like on a week-long camping trip, how you can find and harvest your own snails and then feed them throughout the week, a delightful assortment of herbs, and then on your last night, have escargot.
It's just insane. That's not why we go camping to cultivate snails.
No. Wow. What about fishing, though? I mean, there's something about foraging or hunting, I don't know, for your own... I guess fishing isn't hunting.
Sure,
fishing.
Yeah, you do that.
Just fishing, just me.
Yeah, you be in charge of that.
Okay. Yeah, well, so last night we went to that lovely restaurant in town that we are calling Chico, but could be something else.
Yeah.
And they had that wonderful just whole trout.
Yeah.
Kind of stew. And I think about being able to cook something like that over a campfire, like on a stick, the trout.
Absolutely.
But I think it would require catching said fish.
I don't want to catch fish, but you do that.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. I'm not actually sure. I'll
keep you all posted on that. I got a new mug. It has a white stag logo on it. That's all.
That's a really nice mug, right?
Yeah, it's a really nice
mug. I wonder why you got that mug. Is it a secret?
No, I mean, kind of.
Okay, we'll talk about it next week.
We'll talk about more about the mug next week.
It's a nice mug.
Yeah.
There's good coffee in it. Oh, coffee. So that's one thing I really enjoyed was on the camping trip we did take, making coffee, having coffee.
Right. We were trying out some of the finest camping coffee setup you can have, courtesy of Stumptown Coffee here in Portland. Had a nice nice little hand grinder, little burr grinder that worked really well, and an AeroPress. Ooh, mm-hmm. Popped out on that. An AeroPress that was like, it just works really well. It's almost like having espresso maker. It does such a good job.
I think between that and the morning mimosas, the camping trip started out just fine.
Yeah, we actually didn't have breakfast planned, so we kind of just like ate
coffee and mimosas.
Like leftover hunks of meat and then coffee. It was pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. Shall we proceed?
Let's proceed.
Okay.
More good food ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, updates on all of these, but it's a good segue. Our guest this week is Tressa Yellig of Salt, Fire, and Time here in Portland. Not only did we make her fine website here in Needmore, but she has some very strong and intelligent opinions about food, and I'm hoping that you all stick around and listen to it. I think you'll find it very enjoyable. Tressa.
Oh, hey.
How are you?
Really good.
Excellent. So let's start at the beginning. A lot of people might know you from your current endeavor, Salt, Fire, and Time, but where are you from?
Well, I am originally from Canton, Ohio. And I guess I've passed through a lot of states on the way, but I prefer the West Coast.
Okay. That's cool. I'm from Cleveland, so yeah.
Get out of town.
Yeah. I can't picture where Canton is, but I know
it's
I've heard
it's right in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So are there any I know you spent some time apprenticing in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me a little about that?
Okay. Well, it is a funny story. I was I ended up at cooking school in New York at the Natural Gourmet Institute in Chelsea. And it was kind of an old world food as medicine program. They really advocate for vegan, macrobiotic, Ayurvedic, that kind of healing therapeutic diet. And it was funny because that program seemed fairly limited. I realize now I feel like I gained a lot more in networking and resources than I feel like I necessarily got from the curriculum. But they offered a variety of public classes where guest chefs would come in and teach some kind of topic. And I took a lot of those. Uh-huh. That was probably the most fun for me. And while I was there, I got introduced to traditional foods and ferments and things like that, and kind of found myself recognizing a lot of food from my childhood. My grandmother was really into a lot of this old world food technique, but of course my parents were of the generation of low fat, low protein, low food, low flavor.
Right.
And so we really weren't taught to embrace any of that food, even though we loved it and we gorged ourselves on it. So when I was taking these public classes and sort of reintroducing myself to a lot of these traditions, one of the classes I ended up taking was Jessica Prentice's fermented sodas class. And she was on her book tour with Full Moon Feast, and it just immediately, we fell in very fast. And I was totally in love with this idea of food alchemy and ferments and things like that. And so I worked all the other cooking demos she had on her book tour in New York. And then finally she said, well, you know, we've got this new project going out in Berkeley, and we're calling it a community-supported kitchen. And if you like this kind of thing, which you obviously do, and we like you, why don't you come out and work with us for a while? And I was like, sweet, of course. I can't imagine wanting to do anything else. So I totally skipped graduation and drove straight from New York to Berkeley. And didn't realize how new they were. I mean, they were less than a month old. And so that was really fun and fascinating because there were five of them, and it was such a new concept. The idea of creating these old world foods in a changing menu weekly, and we were sourcing from farms. I was working with a lot of sustainability organizations in the city and apprenticing with this artisan preserve maker and just kind of taking it all in. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of months, I was managing their whole volunteer staff, because at that time, their entire labor base was volunteers. So it was just a changing group of 15 to 20 people a day managing recipes, and it was still really just fleshing out the concepts as we went. But it was thrilling. And, you know, every day we'd all sit down and we'd have lunch together, and, you know, people were bringing all kinds of new ideas in. But I remember feeling very self-conscious because I'd leave every day smelling like chicken broth. Uh-huh. I got really self-conscious about that. But it's funny, then after I left, I started missing that smell.
Yeah, that's funny. I remember when I was working in coffee, I would forget that I had been around coffee all day, and then I'd get in the shower, and I'd be like, is somebody making coffee in the shower with me? Like, oh, wait, that's me that smells like that. Wow, that is strong. So you mentioned the idea of a community-supported kitchen. Besides, like, having a volunteer staff, I guess, what does that mean?
Well, it's a fairly loose definition. It can kind of mean whatever you want. It's still a very new concept. So pretty much the agreed-upon definition of a community-supported kitchen is just a community-scale model for food production.
Okay.
That's it, whatever that means to you. But the hard thing is, I think in their model, what that meant was maximum transparency. Mm-hmm. So sourcing from the community to offer health supportive foods to the community in a way that created community and brought other vendors in. And it kind of just, everyone got to be participate in the food chain in a very visceral way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of felt like it completed the system. And a lot of people have tried. I mean, that was the original model for my biz. And It's sort of the perfect storm down there in Berkeley. I think it's a little tricky to find the same set of components.
Sure, yeah. Berkeley has a reputation. But, did you have experience like going to farms to get involved with that yourself?
Yeah, it was definitely a good introduction there, something I brought into coming up here. You know, I really thought I was going to bring in all these sort of greenwashing themes, you know, seasonal, organic, local, sustainable, slow foods, the whole nine. And then you throw on top of that community outreach and education and transparency and food economy and food security. I mean, it just compounds and compounds and compounds.
Right.
And all of those things are very attractive. But at the end of the day, what I found is it actually ended up diluting the concept quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And really the thing I needed to do was just pick one. Because I think in a place like Portland, where people are already so educated about their food and their choices, they sort of expect that a lot of that exists. So it's funny how I found that where you start saying things like vegan or macrobiotic or Ayurvedic or traditional, people automatically assume that you're sourcing from farms, that it's organic, that it's seasonal, that it's local. And the funny thing is most of them don't ask questions to make sure those things are real.
Right. They assume there's like it's like a pyramid or a ladder where the bottom rungs are already there. But yeah, that's interesting. My biggest impression is the way that people talk about it on the menu, seeing how, like if you go to old wives' tales, there's lots of disclaimers. You can get an entirely separate gluten-free menu and all those things. Whereas if you go to more of a modern upscale restaurant, they're not really specific. They'll just say like, they'll say smashed potatoes or crazy water. And it's like, well, nobody there knows what any of that stuff means. It's just, see, you know, it's almost like lately people give more and more of an impression of the kind of things you're talking about without actually necessarily, who knows what they're doing.
Exactly.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it depends on the experience you're trying to get, right?
True. Yeah.
And so people that are going for an experience that's more of an aesthetic, it's more of a performance, that's mm-hmm. that high art of food,
yeah.
they're more interested in the experience than they are about the sourcing. I mean, now in a place like Portland, you start to see more farms represented. But really, that's not even as much transparency as I'd like to see. Because just because you call it a farm doesn't mean that it's a farm or that their practices are great.
Right.
And it's funny, you know, it's not just a Portlandia skit.
Right.
You know, it's
no,
real. But in a place maybe like Old Wives Tales or something where people know specifically that they can go for an experience of health,
mm-hmm.
Again, there are more questions to that. Because it's gluten-free or dairy-free or soy-free or gosh knows what, like, it doesn't mean that it's organic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't mean that it came from somewhere that you wanted it to come from. But yes, it does meet that requirement. And
mm-hmm.
so I think there's, you know, there's a few more questions I wish people would get in the habit of asking.
Mm-hmm. So, and maybe I'm playing a little bit of a devil's advocate here, but why does it even matter? Just a little.
It matters a lot. The reason it matters is that, you know, the food that we eat forces the greatest expression of our DNA. So, in terms of our healthcare and the way that we move through this world, our bodies are constantly adapting to environmental factors. And so when we bring that external environment in, it's through eating. It's not just about relationship. It's about you know, encouraging our bodies to behave in certain ways. And that is seasonally, rhythmically. We are rhythmic creatures. So eating on a regular basis, how much we eat on a regular basis, where we're eating, you know, things like that, what we're doing to it, there's this very powerful interaction. So it's important because, say you have a predisposition in your family. I love this when people talk about hereditary causes of disease. The funny thing is, now they call it epigenetics. So you might have this hereditary line of, say, breast cancer or something in your family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gene sits, right? It exists in your body, but that doesn't mean it's ever going to turn on if you're existing in a certain place of health.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second your body falls into some kind of dysfunction is where now that genetic expression gets forced in a certain way. So that's what they're calling epigenetics. It's the expression, whether or not we're activating the expression of a predisposition to a certain disease or something like that. So it's not necessarily about identifying the gene as much as it's controlling the gene through good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so food being the strongest thing controlling that expression means that we are completely empowered in the food choices we make every day in how we are compounding and creating that expression, whether it's toward health or disease. So that's why it becomes really important, whether that food was raised in the right way, harvested in the right way, stored in the right way, sprayed with the right things, because all of that compounds to a certain place, especially with animal products. So you see, what's the word I want? They call it a bioconcentration.
Mm.
Because in a vegetable, for instance, it's got a growth cycle of something between, like, what, 24 to 48 days or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But still, all it's really going to be exposed to, other than a few chemicals, is, you know, water, soil, sunshine. An animal, now we're talking about a full year, a full season, and it's what kind of water's going in, what that water was exposed to, whether it was filtered, whether it was tainted. The grass it's eating is also compounding any kind of chemical or otherwise environmental factors, and all of that's getting stored in their muscle and fatty tissue, their organs. All of those things are compounding for an entire year, not 24 to 48 days or something like that, for an entire year, and their bodies are processing it and storing or releasing toxins based on their level of health or disease. So that's why I think if you're going to make a decision, and people are constantly making this about money and pricing and things like that, you know, the better place to sort of get the more bang for your buck is to make decisions about quality animal products, and then, you know, knowing that that concentration is going to be a lot higher there. So it's more important that that quality exists. Not that I have anything against,
mm-hmm.
you know, organic vegetables and things like that, but I think sometimes for a lot of people, just making the decision to eat a fresh ingredient is a huge improvement. And it's funny to think of those stages. You know, here we kind of live in this promised land, right, of seasonality, access, growth, you know, the cycle of planting and everything. It's an agricultural mecca. And so I think we do start to take for granted how much access we have to quality here. Mm-hmm. It's almost a sin if you don't participate in it.
Do you think that... so, you know, the a few years back, I think the CEO of Whole Foods was criticized for drawing a comparison, you know, basically saying that, you know, the healthcare reforms, and I might be paraphrasing wrong here, maybe you know, or maybe neither of us does, but basically saying that, like, the healthcare legislation was unnecessary because people just needed to eat better. And I'm wondering, like, how you feel about, like, if it's fair to draw a comparison between what people spend on healthcare and what they spend, what their food choices are, and if there's like a happy medium there.
I definitely think there's a connection there. And, you know, the joke in my industry, in the nutrition world, is always, well, you pay now or you pay later,
mm-hmm. right?
And so would you need access to all of this health care if you were just taking more preventative measures? And the thing I've always wondered is why there isn't some kind of subsidy for people that were taking better care of their health, that they got a lower rate on their insurance, or they maybe got a better deductible or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were proving that they were invested in not being an expensive problem later. So, yeah, I definitely think there's a connection. And I do think that it's something people just have lost a sense of consequence.
Yeah.
An understanding, an awareness of that consequence. You know, you hear the paradigm all the time, do you eat to live or live to eat? And it's sort of sad that it can't be both. But the fact that people aren't budgeting time to eat and they aren't budgeting money to eat. There was an interesting figure I read that in the 50s, people were in the habit of spending at least half of their paycheck on their food. That was just understood. Don't talk about gardening. Don't talk about sourcing. It was just understood that 50% of your paycheck was going to go into the food you were going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now introduce industrialized food culture, blah, blah, blah. In our generation, I think it's something like we spend less than 10% of our paycheck on the food that we buy.
Wow.
And we get bitter about the fact that now our food is competing with our cable bill.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that's an interesting to think of it, your food choices factoring into your, you know, your healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
It's logical if they consider, you know, whether or not you smoke. At the same time, I wish there was a comprehensive study on the impacts of food choices so that, like, you know how when you go into some grocery stores, they'll put little indicators on, like, the type of fish you're getting, like, where it was sourced.
Mm-hmm.
If they factored in the healthcare cost of your food choice so that there was, like, a separate line item, like, this is going to, like, really impact your healthcare bill. You're buying all this canned food, or, you know, or, you know, this will reduce your healthcare bill, but... That'll never happen.
Well, I'd love to see something too. Well, I you know, just talking about how much of the cost of this good was spent on the packaging.
Yeah.
How much was actually spent on, like, food ingredients?
Yeah, for sure. So how does this fit into your experiences fit into, like, what part of the puzzle are you trying to solve for now at Salt, Fire, and Thyme?
Well, mostly it's trying to recreate a familiarity with a really strong emphasis on rebuilding a trust dynamic between consumer and producer. Because people are highly suspicious nowadays, and they should be, about what goes into the food, where it came from, how it was processed, what they're not being told, how it's going to affect them later. I mean, you bring up smoking,
mm-hmm.
but other vices that are just as powerful and destructive in our body are things like sugar, vegetable oil, caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
These are huge. And not just sugar, but glucose versus fructose versus, you know, lactose, et cetera, like, they're all sugars that the body is working on, and the body will always prioritize survival over thrival, right? So, Salt, Fire, and Thyme, all of these preparations are things that have kind of fallen out of fashion. People don't really think about food thrift or think about food choices from a perspective of, I need to eat this, not only because it tastes good and I'm hungry, but because this is going to rebuild my gut, or, oh, I've got a headache, I should have a glass of water before I reach for an aspirin. But giving people those tools, giving them a positive experience of their food, you empower them to have more control over their life, greater freedom in understanding what they're doing and how they get to interact with the world around them, and also be more in control of just their general disposition. So things like bone broth, organ meats, ferments, all of these participate in different ways between the gut and the brain and building immunity, but also creating balance. You're restoring the body's equilibrium so that it can absorb more nutrition, it can be more like efficient in how it's spending and using its own energy, and what amount of that energy it's going to put into healing and new action. So these foods that Salt, Fire, and Thyme makes, not only are they kind of old and forgotten about, but most of them take a while and a certain degree of intuition. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that they've fallen out of fashion from a taste perspective, it's that they've fallen out of fashion from a production perspective, because people don't spend time in their kitchens. We had a running joke for a while when the Occupy thing was all going on about, we need to teach people to occupy their kitchens. Occupy your kitchen. So the thought was, well, if people... Initially, I thought I'd go in and do a lot more education, give people the tools, teach them to feed themselves. Well, nobody wanted to do that, because it wasn't just about giving them skills, it was about building an intuition. And what I found is no amount of talking that I did was ever convincing people enough. You have to kind of talk them out of their heads. We're too intelligent these days. We have too much information. So
jaded,
I have to come in and convince someone that what they already believe to be true is wrong before I get a chance to convince them that what I'm doing is right. Mm-hmm. I got tired of doing that. It's like banging your head against a wall. Why not just give them an experience? Because once someone feels good, now they want to know the whys and the hows. Now they're on board of understanding what part of this interacted with my physiology. Why did my headache go away? Why do I have more energy? Whoa, I slept really well last night for the first time in a long time. I can't believe that I didn't have, you know, a digestive upset after that. So giving people these foods is my way of A, introducing them, B, getting them on board, and making it really, C, making it really, really efficient so that they don't have to take time out of their schedule. So it's a baby steps thing. I give them these ingredients that now they can work with, in a way that they're slowly recreating that relationship to the food they're eating and the way they engage food in their lives. So by taking that time piece out of it for them, it maximizes the learning curve. They don't have to take responsibility for that until they're ready. And then, sure, don't buy my products. Make your own at home. But that's sort of the missing piece, is that when people are so desperate... And really, my people aren't necessarily people, I wish they were, more people that are just trying to work from an optimal health, preventative healthcare kind of space. But usually when people come to me, it's because they're desperate. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that they don't have a relationship to food, or they don't know how to work with this, and they don't have an intuition. It's that they physically don't have the energy, or the brain space, or the capacity to put this all together. So they just need someone to hold their hand for a little bit, give them the tools they need until they're strong enough to take responsibility for that piece themselves. And that's what we do.
Okay. So you mentioned like bone broth as an example. Is that's something that's time consuming to make? I've never made it.
Not surprising. Yeah.
It is not at all, no.
Yeah, it takes about 3 days to make a batch.
Okay.
And give and at least 8 hours, but we take 3 days to make it. And that's what gives us such a supreme product, is that we have the tools, the capacity, the ability to keep something at a consistent temperature for 3 days, so that we make sure you're getting as much out of it as you possibly can. You know, the average person at home doesn't want to leave their stove on that long, wouldn't feel comfortable leaving their stove on that long.
Right.
And also probably wouldn't want to leave it on their stove for that long. You know, the thing I usually hear people say is, man, my whole house smells like bone broth now. How do you roast the bones? Man, that really stinks.
So you do that for them, at least at first.
Totally.
Yeah. Now, if someone... you know, is buying your products to get in there, like, this really does make me feel better. Is that, like, Can you then show them how to make it or train them or give them a recipe or empower them?
We offer a lot of classes too.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I teach a lot with NCNM. I'm probably going to do a continuing ed series with OCOM. I teach with the Wellspring Nutrition Program. I do their cooking section. And then we do a lot of other public classes too. And it's all that stuff, nutrition or cooking techniques or, you know, creative new sauces this season, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is how to integrate these ingredients, how to use these products, and also how to make them too.
Okay. And I notice on your, this is really a nice website, but
yeah.
I know, I'm just kidding. I noticed that you have a lot of, and you mentioned earlier, fermented foods.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about fermented foods that's good for people? Like, I love kimchi. Is that?
That's great.
Okay. That's a fermented food? Okay.
Yeah.
That's
it
a good.
Counts.
Okay. Why? That makes me feel good. It might be because it's really spicy and I have allergies, but like, what is it about fermented? And when I was on a raw vegan diet, I was eating a lot of fermented foods and like, that is why I fell in love with pickles, like the bubbies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What's good about fermented foods for people?
Well, so the interesting thing about food is, you know, when we eat a food, we think about what are the nutrients in that food, but also the other reason you're eating it is not just for the vitamins and the minerals. You're also wanting it for those live enzymes, and those live enzymes are part of what would naturally break that food down. Now, we've got a lot of enzymes in our body that also participate in breaking down nutrients, and that's kind of how the whole digestive process works. There are some nutrients that are only created in your body by virtue of that process of breaking down the food that you ate. So without the body actually acting on that food, you would never have access to that nutrition. So, you know, raw foods, you have a harder time accessing some of the vitamin mineral content in that food, but you get a lot more of the enzymes. In a cooked food, you've broken down the enzymes and a lot of the plant fibers, so you're getting access to a lot more of the vitamins and minerals, but you've killed the enzymes. So it's really important to have a balance of both.
Huh.
The beautiful thing about fermented foods is that you get both, because what you've done is create an environment that's attracting wild bacteria, building a certain amount of lactic acid, and collectively, all of those bacteria and enzymes are working to break down that food just enough while keeping it alive. So you're basically getting something that's pre-digested and also adding more enzymatic activity to your gut. So in doing that, it's like you make the whole process a lot more expeditious.
Okay. So you're fast-tracking your health.
Well, you're fast-tracking your digestion.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I've visited your space before, and mm-hmm. I drank something that was very red. Was that beet juice?
The beet kvass.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
So the beet kvass is a lacto-fermented beet infusion. It's actually a traditional Eastern European drink, kvass, and it was traditionally made with bread crusts and rye berries, and it was kind of their version of lemonade, just probiotic. So meaning it's not alcoholic, but it's one of those very bacterially rich fermented sodas, and effervescent, sour, really refreshing, full of electrolytes, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And so beet kvass is a version of that, the same preparation, but made with beets so that you get the gluten-free factor because so many people today are sensitive. And but because of the beets, it also becomes blood cleansing, blood building, great for your liver. And it's really, really just fresh and clean. You know, I get a lot of people that are very shocked because they're expecting sort of that Harvard beets, sweet beet, canned beet experience of beets. Tragedy. and then they try it, and this is crisp and clean, and the spices in it also help that effect. And it's a really nice little drink. But, you know, one of the things that people always kind of, you know, are surprised by, again, is the action of watching your body respond to this living food.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first time you'll see people often get flushed, you know, they'll get rosy cheeks or maybe they'll get a headache or something like that because they've just dived in so quickly. And so my only advice would be, you know, if this is your first time on beet kvass and you don't want to spend the day on the toilet, you know, maybe start slow.
Yeah. Same advice goes for when you first discover fresh cherries, and it's like, decided to eat a whole bowl of them, which I've done. It's terrible.
Cleansing.
Yeah, indeed. So how did you end up in Portland? After is this where you came from, Berkeley? Or
kind of. Well, what happened was I was working in Northern California, and long story short, I got really sick and ended up healing myself with a lot of this food stuff and didn't need to do a lot of what I thought I was going to need to do to recover. So I kind of found myself in this place where I didn't have to spend all this money on the healthcare I was planning, and I didn't have to spend 4 months in recovery. And so I was like, well, maybe this is a sign from the universe that I should just do something I really want to do. And I had come out to the Pacific Northwest when I was 18 and just really fell in love with it and had always wanted to come back. So I was like, well, that's it. I'm going to go to the Pacific Northwest. I'm going to start the CSK of my dreams, and I'm just going to make it happen. And so I flew out here for about 10 days, and I did a lot of informational interviews with folks between Seattle and Portland. That was the decision. Because, you know, in the Bay, everybody talks about Portland as this, like, hush-hush, like, what do I want to say, promised land, you know? They don't have taxes. You know, like, you can spend so much money on food. And so I wanted to check it out, although it was funny because I remember my friends saying to me, well, you trust that there's a lot of hipsters there. And I'm like, what's a hipster? I don't even understand what I'm getting myself into.
We have hippies
into.
Here, too.
So I came up, and I really thought I was going to go to Seattle. And then, it's a funny little story, I guess. I'd gone to cooking school with a woman who was now editing for Edible Portland. And so she had given me a copy when we were visiting, and I was reading it in my hotel room. And in it, I saw this ad for another woman who had a company at the time called Folklore Foods, and it said community-supported kitchen theater. And I thought, no, how can there already be one in Portland? This is ridiculous. So I immediately called her, and I said, look, there's got to be a way we can collaborate. I don't want to compete with the vision you already have, but I know I got to do this. And she said, well, it doesn't exist. I just put the ad in there for bait. Why don't you come over? So I went over to her house, and ended up staying the night there, which was great. But that's where I met her and two other ladies who ended up saying that they really wanted to partner with me on the biz. And that was kind of the difference. It's like, well, I could go to Seattle and do this by myself, or I could come to Portland and have three partners. It seemed like a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was right before Christmas. So I went home, Christmas, New Year's, drove out on the 2nd. and we started, and that was pretty much how Portland happened.
Okay. How long ago was this?
2009.
Okay.
January 2009.
That's great. Do you personally, I'm going to ask you some personal questions. Do you have a favorite fermented food?
That's so hard. No, it's really hard to say.
I already
that.
Said kimchi, so you
well,
can't
the hard
say
thing
that.
Is, like, I'm deeply attached to cabbages, but I'm kind of spent on eating them. Like, you can imagine, like, being in this fermented zone all the time, you kind of, it's, you know, everybody knows cabbage is the sauerkraut, and I love kraut. Like, I feel like I identify with kraut, but but I just can't eat it anymore. At least not right now. We're seeing other people.
are you, like, part German? Is it German in your blood?
Yes, I'm German,
Yeah, I had a grandmother who, like, I don't know if I ever went over there for dinner and she didn't make something fermented. Mm-hmm. So I always have very fond memories of that. And, like, sometimes Candace will make that for dinner. And that's very nice. Usually, like, a pot roast and, like, a sauerkraut or something. But,
yeah.
Doing this for a living, are there restaurants that you like, or do you not get to go out much, or do you have a favorite restaurant in Portland?
No, I go out all the time.
Okay, good.
I love to eat out.
Okay.
It's funny, I find myself a lot at Kier. I know it's not really known for its food, but it should be, because...
Is it right off Burnside?
Yeah. It's a sweet little wine bar, all old world wines.
I love that
amazing
place,
amazing palate. Her small plates are... And I seriously think they've got the best mussel plate in town.
Okay,
can't get enough of it.
Okay. I'll have to go back there and do that. Yeah, I think I just had wine there, but...
Yeah, I love that spot. And, well, of course, I'm always really picky looking at people's menus and where they're sourcing it, if they're pulling that, like, you know... farm trick that's really just a packing house. I'm trying to think where else I end up going a lot. I really love the Bollywood Theater. I think he's doing a beautiful job.
That place is a lot of fun, for sure.
and Ned Ludd.
Okay.
I think that place is amazing.
I still haven't been there, but yeah, wow. Okay. do you not drink caffeine?
No, absolutely do.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Just maybe in moderation? Or
well, you know, everybody's allowed to have a few vices, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, that makes me feel better. I mean, not that, you know. Yeah, it's funny. The biggest thing that bothers me is when you'll hear this rave about a restaurant and that they're, you know, they'll talk about their sourcing and all that stuff, and then you'll go by there one day and there's just like a Cisco truck delivering, and you're like, well, you try to give them the benefit of the doubt, like, well, maybe they just get, I don't know, their to-go cups from Cisco, I don't know, but probably not, you know, like, it's
a little heartbreaking.
There's no, sure. If you're doing food service, you'll get a score and everything. They'll check your kitchen, but it's not like they're checking where it's sourced from.
Exactly.
Do you sometimes feel that restaurants just flat out lie?
Not intentionally.
Just use creative wording to get around that kind of weasel words.
The expression a lot at the bottom of menus: we source organic whenever possible.
I totally know that phrase. Yeah, whenever possible. Yeah.
Or as much as we can.
Right.
And I get it. Like, there are real, real food costs involved, and it's very hard to then, because it's not just the restaurant's fault. I can't put all the fault on the restaurant. It's also the consumer's fault, because they're not demanding it and they're not manning up to pay for it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the hard thing, you know. For instance, if a farm is really raising a beautiful pastured bird, for instance, and this bird is allowed to forage, they're making sure the feed has no GMO, it's been given enough time and water and sunshine to grow appropriately, and they're slaughtering on farm, and that farmer's making an effort to get that into a restaurant, well, their production's a lot smaller. So those birds per each are going to be a lot more expensive. And then if they're coming to this chef who's saying, all right, on our restaurant menu, we need to set up entrees somewhere between $15 and $30. If it's any more than that, we really can't ask people to pay, or it takes us into a whole other ballgame. And for something like chicken, there's a psychology around what people want to pay. People can put a lot of specificity into what they're sourcing for when they're going home. Mm-hmm. But when they go out, people are really looking more for an experience than they are for that quality ingredient. And that's why I think, you know, restaurants will make allowances. For instance, you know, Draper Valley Farms. This is a local company. Maybe not the most sustainable, maybe not necessarily completely organic, but, you know, you're supporting them as a local business, and I think that means a lot. Or, you know, Carlton Farms. Well, Carlton Farms is not a farm. It's Carlton Meat and Packing.
Yeah. Right.
But it sounds so much more romantic when you say Carlton Farms, you know. But, again, people feel good about that because, again, they feel like they're supporting local. And so it's finding that balance, I think, as a chef, where you're finding a price point that works in a framework that people feel comfortable with. Because if you were actually saying to them, well, in order for us to source exactly what you want, that means you have to take a $10 entree and charge $30 for it, to just for the turnaround, to cover waste, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there are a lot of folks that just will not follow through on that, and I really appreciate that that's real. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember hearing a story how Olympic Provisions had that problem. You know, they work with different sources, and they had tried to work with a Square Peg Farm, I think it was, to do a small batch salami, and it was $1 more. $1 more per salami. And people wouldn't pay.
Huh.
And it was that $1 difference made all the difference in the world.
They should have put like a gold sticker on it. I'm kidding.
Special wrapping. but it's hard, like, and that's where I feel like in a place like Portland, there's a lot of highfalutin ideas, but follow through. You know, everybody makes compromises. I know that's just life. Yeah. Nobody's going to be that perfect, but that's why I say you make decisions about what dollars are going to vote where.
Yeah.
And if you had to make that decision, it might not be that consistently across the board everything's beautifully organic, but you do the best you can.
Yeah.
And I think as long as people are trying to include some organic, they're still ahead of the curve.
I feel like you have a pretty reasonable and mature view of that, probably because you deal with that, you know, like it's like, you know, no one could afford, you know, or it would be hard to do everything absolutely perfectly right for everyone, certainly at with 7 billion people.
It's an enormous lifestyle change. Yeah. I don't think it's impossible. In fact, I think it's very doable. But it's one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if for instance, you drink coffee, mm-hmm. right? I drink coffee. If you're gonna drink coffee, drink a good quality coffee. It's like to make that a cheap thing when it's something that like makes that big a difference. I think why not just go for the quality thing? If you're gonna do it right.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, I'm not necessarily going to be very particular about where I buy toilet paper or hand soap or something like that, but I am going to be very particular about where I source my animal proteins. And so it's things like that where maybe I have a Costco membership for some of this stuff, but I would probably never buy dairy from a place like Costco.
Right. Right.
But I can get all the Q-tips there I ever wanted.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Sage I made advice. This. Comment, and I think I rattled a lot of feathers. It was another interview where I said something about I can't wait for a day where grocery stores are just places we go for paper products.
Right, yeah. And,
but, you know, again, like I said, it's a lifestyle choice. Like, for a lot of people, just having enough forks to feed everyone in their house is a big step.
Yeah.
Or, you know, making time to cook something rather than just buying prepared foods. But even buying prepared foods is still better to me than people having to eat out 3 meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed how many people really just don't use their kitchens, and I don't blame them. Like, we don't budget time to eat, to digest, to source your food. I mean, it is another part-time job. And so I think, you know, you make little goals, and as people start seeing results and seeing the benefit of that action, it builds a lot more momentum to do the next action. So I think it's better to start small with consistent successes than for someone to take on too much massive failure. They feel totally flawed and imperfect, and they go back to doing exactly what they were doing before. The worst thing, the thing I hate seeing people do all the time is encourage apathy, you know, because of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there are a lot of enthusiasts, and bless their heart, their enthusiasm kind of knocks everybody out of the water.
Right.
You know, like all the food mongering fear mongering that went on with what was the Food Inc.? Those movies that come out and they terrify you.
Yeah.
Because the problem is they come in and they're like, yes, there are all these problems with industrial food manufacturing, duh.
Yeah.
But then they offer no creative solutions.
Right.
So people are terrified. I don't know what to eat. I don't know what to do. I just know I can't participate in that because that's terrible. But I don't know where to go to make a better decision. So, shit, this just got really complicated. Well, I guess I'm just one person, and what does it matter anyway? And
right.
It's like it never happened.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, when there's like a lot of protests, I always hear the phrase compassion fatigue, where people, they feel like there's just so much wrong and so much to protest that, you know what, screw it, I'll just, you know, forget that, you know. But but it's like, you know, it also reminds me of a phrase I use talking about design, that like the perfect is the enemy of the good. Like, don't try to be perfect.
Yeah.
Just, you know, like if you were, like with what you're talking about, it's like if you just take control of breakfast consistently.
Huge.
And yeah, then you'll just start to feel like you have a foothold. And every day at a recent TEDx in Portland, Katie Bingham and Burt was talking, and she's a designer, and she was talking about how she had credit card debt, and it was so overwhelming for her, she didn't know what to do. So she just started drawing every day, like every invoice, every bill that would come from, just to just draw it. And it would just force her to take some time and just think consciously about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's kind of maybe what people can do with food, is just like, you know, don't like abandon eating out completely. Just maybe stop eating out for breakfast on the way to work in your car. Like, just, you know, get up a half hour earlier. You know, we after having a couple of kids, the mornings get crazy. It's like, well, we just set the alarm a little earlier and can still make breakfast, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
can still like have some eggs and stuff, something with a little protein rather than just, you know, microwaving a bowl of oatmeal or something.
Yeah.
Which is probably not the worst thing either, but yeah. I just went on a little tangent there.
That's okay. Breakfast is very important.
So, in summary, do you have like one piece of advice you'd give to someone who's just feeling frustrated and having headaches and is overwhelmed for just making one step in the right direction?
I really feel like if you were going to do three things
okay,
that
three,
would make
better.
A massive impact on your health, okay. Really simple, it would be improving your water intake and making sure that that's clean water, trying to eliminate as much sugar as possible from your diet, and eliminating vegetable oils. And I really feel like if you can do those three things, you've exponentially improved your health.
Yeah,
it's really, it doesn't have to be complex.
Great. Wow. All right. So people can find you at saltfireandtime.com. Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere else that people should be following on social media or anything?
Twitter, Facebook, yeah. Those things all
okay.
exist.
Yeah. And they could find that on your site. And thank you so much for chatting with me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Two tracks in GarageBand, how hard could it be? Hi, Dan.
Hi, Ray.
How are you?
Good.
You went camping last weekend too, huh?
I did.
Anything exciting? Any bear attacks or anything?
Nothing that exciting, no.
No, okay.
Went to Cape Disappointment, and it was not disappointing.
Yeah, I think that was probably got its name a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just guessing.
Probably.
Yeah. You know, everything was either disappointing or devil-ridden back then in Oregon. Like, the whole state was just like a devil-ridden disappointment.
Massachusetts is like that as well.
Is it?
That,
yeah.
That Puritan fear just went into the naming of everything. I'm also pretty well sunburned, like, over most of my body.
Yeah.
Which makes me very cold.
Did you get the backs of your ankles burnt like me?
Top of my feet
is the
worst part of my
body. Oh, wow. That's even... Wow.
I forgot to, like, you know, give that one its covering.
It's due.
So the tops of my feet are beet red, which is nice. People like that.
Yeah. Ladies. ladies like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like... Of a man with burned feet. I think my phone is just gone. So I have just installed iOS 7 Beta 3.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies. And this thing is getting progressively worse. Now my phone won't even turn on. The last update was like, it somehow broke my top button. It's so rough that it's actually causing hardware malfunctions.
That's crazy. So that you couldn't lock your screen?
I could, but it took a lot of effort. Like, on like the fifth attempt, it would finally work. But now it won't even turn on.
That's unfortunate.
Oh, no, there it goes. I don't know. It's weird.
So you got a few more months like that, huh? Or a month or two.
What the hell was I thinking? I was unwise.
You should chart, like, the progress
stability.
Of it.
Stability.
The stability of the iOS.
It's getting worse before it gets better, I think. Yeah.
Are you seeing noticeable changes, like, when you update the beta?
No, relatively minor changes. I mean, the beta 2 added a couple apps. Hmm. The voice recording app is, like, completely redesigned. You can, like, see waveforms in it and everything. It's, like, way better. And the Nike...
Can you actually run it?
I can actually run
it.
That one nice. Actually works fine, yeah.
Cool.
But overall, no. I'm hoping more than oh my God. Whoa. Okay, they changed something on this one. Beta 3, when you turn the display on, the background zooms in slightly.
When you turn the display on
press that top.
Even another animation.
Yeah, there's another animation. They are really going all out on the animations here. I've noticed that when you're looking at the iTunes radio, yeah, the button's acting weird. When you look at the iTunes radio, it shows a stack of album covers, and they're in 3D. Like, not like cover flow, but as you scroll vertically on the screen, the depth actually moves along.
So beautiful.
And on the home screen, yeah, it's pretty cool. On the home screen, I've noticed that the numeric badges and the little pop-up dialogues are all on their own layer, so the parallax actually affects like each item on the screen separately. Oh yeah, and this I think is new. I don't know, it's ridiculous.
Those animations are so impressive that I think I saw someone tweet a few like when iOS 7 came out, like the animations are so awesome that it's conceivable there's like a fork of iOS that's been being worked on for the last couple of years just on animations. Like there's just maybe like an animations team that's just been handling that.
The thing is they clearly have, because completely separate from the iOS versions, they always have libraries they're developing in-house, and mm-hmm. they announced at the WWDC this year that there was a new animation library for like layered interactive whatever. Like basically it was that effect that you can use in your apps. And typically Apple has been unveiling those kinds of things user facing at the same time as the OS, but they're always something they've been working on for a while. And mm-hmm. so like that the parallax itself works fine, but man, on my iPad 3 iOS is so bad. It's even worse.
Do you have just like a couple minutes after you launch an app, like no matter what it is?
Just like what's funny is the way it'll crash. When it crashes, a lot of times it's as if the layers of the display are blown away one at a time, and then the apple shows up. So you'll see like the last five apps will flash by, and then you'll just see an apple. I don't know if like perhaps it's actually keeping like more than one app stacked or something. I have no idea why it does that. It's super weird.
Crazy.
Yeah, there's like some serious plumbing changes in here. Anyway, on a lighter note, let's talk about Roscoe Holcomb.
Loved it.
Am I saying that right?
Sure, why not?
Holcomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dan listened to it and loved it. I listened to it briefly. It's terrible. It's like that thing where like I almost went into an SNL thing there, but no, it's that thing where like you
and you're stopping yourself. Why? I see no reason to stop yourself.
It's like when the deadline is in a week, I'm more likely to do it than if the deadline is in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it was like by tomorrow morning at 8, you know, you'd stay up all night and you'd definitely get it done. It's like the longer you have to do something, less likely you are to complete the task.
Procrastinator's ethos.
Yeah, I don't know what that's. I don't know what. There's got to be a name for that. But so I never really listened to it. But you liked it.
I did.
Why don't you tell us what the hell it is?
The high lonesome sound of Roscoe Holcomb is exactly what you'd think it is. I mean, it's he totally looks like William Burroughs.
Yeah.
Like right down to the tie clip. probably not the track marks, but everything else right there. But I turned it on. It sounded exact. The first track is Moonshiner, which it's like a variation of the traditional Moonshiner folk song.
Okay.
That like Bob Dylan has played, Uncle Tupelo has done a cover of, and like the first two lines are the same, and then the lyrics are different after that on his version, which earlier version, and it's a cappella, and I thought it was Ralph Stanley. He sounds exactly like Ralph Stanley. So clearly, like, I was like, oh, Ralph Stanley must have been, like, really influenced by him. But he wasn't, Ralph Stanley was on record a good 15 years before Roscoe Holcomb was ever recorded. Mm. So it, like, seems to be, like, the natural sound of that part of Appalachia or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's
vocal
from
style.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
He was a miner, a construction worker, farmer.
Yeah.
Huh.
But, yeah, a really good, like, that. What's that, clawhammer banjo picking.
Yeah.
Like, it's mostly just, like, there's a lot of a cappella songs on here where he's just singing in that, like, high. Apparently the high lonesome sound was coined for him.
Like, really?
It was coined for his voice, according to Wikipedia. I don't know how valid that is, but... Yeah, it's...
Oh, that's great.
In reference to his voice, so... But yeah, if you're familiar with the Stanley Brothers, or whichever Stanley brother joined Bill Monroe in the 50s, and they have the similar voice. That sound is will be very familiar, and it's really wonderful.
He's serious. He's sincere, this guy.
Yeah. It's
deadpan. Makes me want to learn banjo. It'd be fun to play banjo. such a quirky instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, do you want to draw a number out of the hat there? See who we're going to listen to?
Crack it open. We don't seem... It looks like I'm going end of the alphabet.
Okay.
It's like we're...
Yeah.
Front heavy. All right.
Index. Let's listen to Index.
It's my favorite track, A through C. Wow. The Yardbirds.
Oh God, I was afraid you were going to say yes.
That was the other option.
Oh, it was?
Like that's what that was. What the cringe was for.
I was thinking this whole time to make it not be yes.
Please don't let it be yes.
Not yes. Okay, Yardbirds. That's fine. Which one?
Over, under, sideways, down.
Okay.
/ Roger the Engineer.
Oh, double album.
Different titles for different release.
Oh, okay.
I think the U.S. title was over, under, sideways, down. The UK release was Roger the Engineer, I think. That's what it looks like.
Okay. Okay.
Let's see, 66. So
this will be good. That's my favorite year of music. It is.
Really?
66.
Okay.
If I had to take 1 year of music to a desert island, it would be 66.
Is that Pet Sounds and Rubber Soul?
It is.
Okay. What else is in 66?
Actually, no. Rubber Soul is actually is the December of 65 or something. You know, that's harsh. 65 would be like a close second, I think. But no, Pet Sounds is definitely 66, and you know, Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be able to take singles too, I assume.
Sure. Who's limiting this?
Yeah, I mean, this is my,
that would just be mean.
Right now,
you're only allowed LPs. We only have one size box. All right, so Yardbirds for next week.
Yeah, that's that. I actually don't have that here, but that is an album I would probably even pick up.
I wonder.
66. That means it was
which of the three of them still were
Clapton.
Playing guitar?
It was still Clapton. Still Clapton. Yeah, it was like, wasn't it Clapton, then Beck, then Page?
Yep. Yeah. The first sentence is: the Yardbirds had Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and/or Jimmy Page on lead guitar. Okay.
There was like briefly a time when Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page were both playing, but I don't think there are really any recordings of that.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'm not my normal talkative self today. I was just talking about how I didn't get much sleep.
Yeah.
It was like the longer the weekend goes on, the later I stay up. But, you know, just so much excitement. You know, there was like a lot of fireworks, and there was, we went out to the boating place. It was too rough to go boating, but we went out to like Lake Vancouver with our friends. On the 4th. Actually got to see the fireworks. Did you see fireworks?
From our balcony.
You were back in town?
We didn't leave till Friday.
Oh, okay.
So we were in town on Thursday. And, got the kid to bed.
Good view from your balcony?
Sort of. We can like, see the, like, reflection of the fireworks downtown on the clouds.
Oh, you know? Okay. Oh, that's...
But people were blowing stuff up all over our neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So we had, you know...
There's no shortage
ample,
of that.
Ample things to look at and enjoy.
It can be frustrating driving. Like, you always feel like you turn a corner rolling into someone's neighborhood and, like, everyone kind of dashes out of the street and you're like, so is there, like, a live firecracker like in the middle of the road that I'm going to be driving over right as it explodes or something?
That had never occurred to me. That's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying to be me. alone and frightened in this great big world. I'm going to introduce a new segment here. What Ray's afraid of? No, not really. The funniest thing my daughter said last week. Here it is. She opened the tent door for us, uh-huh. And she said, and I quote, "Allow me." She's very polite for a 4-year-old.
Very chivalrous.
Allow me. She also yesterday said, "My whole body hurts for real." It didn't. It didn't hurt.
No.
She's just around lots of like older people who whose bodies do hurt.
Allow me.
Yeah, for real. You know what? I forgot to mention, we also went to an art opening for Amy Ruppel that mm-hmm. was a dinner thing.
Saw pictures of that on Instagram. Yeah, that looks fabulous.
Like, it was awesome. It was like... should have brought this up with Candace since she was there. I don't know what kind of food it was. I think it was just kind of Japanese food. I think the gallery owner had just gotten back from Japan and had some friends do it. But it was just like, you know, kind of family style, two giant long tables. And Amy had done her artwork so that, like, there were giant, giant paintings, like the size of our jerkwad ostrich here.
Mm-hmm.
Just in this style, basically. But the light fixtures had been hung so that they actually looked like they were lighting up the painting. Like just a little bulb hanging down there. And I was like looking at the art and I was like, oh, this is great. But there'd be like an area on the painting that was kind of washed out. Or one was like moths, but they were all kind of going around a certain place. And then as I was walking around the room, I was looking back and I was realizing, oh, these are designed so that the light fixture is like what they're... like. And then one, there was like a bear or a porpoise or something. Can't tell them apart. And they were like, it was like looking at the light fixture. And then there was one that was like, there was no light fixture in front of it, but the animal was looking at the neighboring light fixture. It was like, it was such a cool way to do a show, you know?
So whoever was curating and setting up, Amy worked with them pretty closely. And
I think she was like painting them like, up till the last minute to like fit the space.
That's fantastic. Where was the gallery?
The gallery was the Hellion Gallery, and it's kind of an old town,
mm-hmm.
kind of by the White Stag Building, for example.
For example,
just
a random building,
just a random
pulling out of the ether.
Nice building goes with my mug. Yeah. So, friends, we're back next week, episode 21. Our guest. We'll have a guest. And be sure to listen to Over, Under, Sideways, Down, or for our friends across the pond, Roger the Engineer. I have a feeling that the U.S. name is more commercially friendly, since that was an actual song. Roger the Engineer is probably like on a lark, as they say. It's on a lark.
It's probably like something horribly insulting in like Cockney rhyming slang or something.
Oh yeah, that could be too. Yeah,
like it means something.
It's like
filthy.
A nickname for genitals or right. something. Yeah. Okay. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Roger the Engineer. I'm always going to think that.